to China, which is about 40, or in Europe, which is about 45. So we know that the disease affects young people a lot less. The problems are there are many other diseases like HIV, malaria, tuberculosis, malnutrition, and they're going to negatively impact. Social distancing, as was discussed by your previous contributor, social distancing is not going to be possible. It's going to be possible for the urban rich, but not for the majority of the population.
Yannis Benamoore, we thank you so much for being with us, Assistant Professor of Global Health and Microbiological Sciences at Columbia University, Executive Director of the Center for Sustainable Development at the Earth Institute. And that does it for our show. These numbers have just come in. We just gotten the record number on unemployment. U.S. unemployment claims have hit 6.6 million, another record high as layoffs continue amidst the pandemic. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh from New York City. Thanks so much.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
At KBOO, we think that all communities deserve to be fully informed on the policies and decisions that will impact their lives, and we need your help to make that happen. We're looking for citizen journalists to help collect, report, and broadcast the news. Do you think that there are groups that are underrepresented or marginalized by the mainstream media? Are you aware of social, political, or environmental activities that don't have adequate visibility? Are there important issues in your town or region that aren't getting coverage? This is your chance to give a voice to the voiceless. You don't have to have experience, and you don't have to come into KBOO's Portland studio. You can contribute from wherever you live. If you have some basic writing skills and a desire to get the word out, we want you. Just send an email with your idea and contact information to newsdirector, that's all one word, newsdirector@kboo.fm, and include the words citizen journalist in the subject line, and the news team will contact you. Once again, send that email to newsdirector@kboo.fm.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, passing the 1 million mark for people who have tested positive for the coronavirus. Oregon's unemployment claims surpass another grim record, and the federal stockpile of personal protective equipment for medical workers is running low. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 2nd, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. As the coronavirus outbreak continues to take its toll on the economy, the number of Americans filing for unemployment across the country in the past week has shattered previous records. KBOO's Yasmin Kobanoglu has more on the story.
A record 6.6 million Americans filed for unemployment benefits last week. Analysts had predicted a jobless claims total of 3 to 6 million for the week ending in March 28th, after many businesses across the country were forced to close due to the coronavirus outbreak. The number of people filing for unemployment benefits shatters the previous record set the week before of 3.28 million. That brings the two-week total of Americans filing for unemployment to about 10 million. Some economists have said the actual number of unemployed Americans could be much higher, since many applicants have had trouble filing claims because state labor departments are so overwhelmed. Previously, the highest week for unemployment claims was in 1982, with 695,000 filing claims. During the Great Recession, the high was 665,000 claims in March of 2009. Those at the lower end of the wage scale, as well as communities of color, have been especially impacted. The U.S. Department of Labor has said that the service industry is among the hardest hit by the pandemic. Other industries that have been heavily impacted include healthcare and social assistance, manufacturing, retail, and construction.
For the first time, the world coronavirus case toll passed the 1 million mark today, and the number of people in the Pacific Northwest with the coronavirus continues to rise. At the same time, record-shattering unemployment numbers hit Oregon hard. KBOO's Annette Newell has the latest.
The coronavirus cases are still rising in the Pacific Northwest. By this morning, Oregon was reporting 736 people had tested positive and linked the virus to 19 deaths. In Washington, where the first major outbreak in the country was reported, 5,984 people had tested positive for COVID-19, resulting in 247 deaths. The latest research on Oregon's COVID-19 cases confirms the need for continued social distancing efforts, according to the Oregon Health Authority. Updated projections from health researchers show there is strong evidence that the measures currently in place in Oregon are reducing the transmission of the disease. The most recent data suggests that the current social distancing measures could cut the spread by 50 to 70% if Oregonians maintain the limitations on virus-spreading interactions into early May. They also show the state could meet the likely demand for hospital beds if people continue with current strategies. Copying what's happening across the country, job losses in Oregon last week sharply rose. A record 92,700 Oregonians filed for unemployment the week that ended March 28th. The Oregon Employment Department says that's about above the record-shattering previous week of 76,500. The week before that, just 4,900 Oregonians had filed jobless claims. The counties with the most people filing for unemployment were Multnomah with 10,900, Washington with 5,300, and Lane at 4,200. The largest number of claims were in the leisure and hospitality sector, which includes hotels and restaurants. They had 15,500 unemployment claims in Oregon. Oregon Senator Ron Wyden had this response. He said, on day one of negotiations for the COVID-19 relief package, I made it clear that my bottom line was helping workers replace lost wages. Modernizing our outdated unemployment system ensures that all workers, including self-employed and gig economy workers, get the help they need. My provision in the COVID-19 relief bill supercharges unemployment to provide workers with an additional $600 a week. This will be a lifeline for the millions of workers who have been hit by this economic wrecking ball. Oregon's other U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley also responded to the shedding of jobs. Millions of Americans' lives have been thrown into chaos, he said, through no fault of their own. We need to throw lifelines out to struggling families, and we need to get those lifelines out now. As the federal government works to implement the last relief package and Congress writes the next one, we have to keep our priorities straight and make sure the help gets to the people who need it the most. Many of the state's news organizations are cutting back, even though the demand for Oregon news is soaring. In Portland, Salem, and Bend, newspapers have cut jobs over the past few weeks, even as they tried to cover the effects of the coronavirus outbreak on Oregon communities. Gannett, which publishes Salem Statesman Journal, is requiring its workers to take an unpaid week every month through June. And EO Media, which owns papers in Bend and Astoria, laid off 47 workers last week. The Portland Tribune cut reporters' hours. Other publications like the Portland Mercury, the Portland Observer, Portland Monthly, and Street Roots have suspended or delayed issues. For the KBOO Evening News, I'm Annette Newell.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, the country's top medical expert on the coronavirus pandemic and a member of President Trump's coronavirus task force, is facing threats. He is now forced to have security from law enforcement with him at all times, including when he's at home. Fauci's advice to President Trump for the country to remain in as locked down as possible to help control the spread of the coronavirus has not earned fans among some far right-wing voices. Fauci said today that he remains focused on his work fighting the pandemic. despite reports of threats to his safety. In an interview on the Today Show, he said, quote, I've chosen this life. I mean, I know what it is. There are things about it that are sometimes disturbing, but you just focus on the job you have to do and just put all that stuff aside and try as best as possible not to pay attention to it. Fauci has received a security detail from the federal government. Health and Human Services Inspector General agents are providing Fauci with the protection. The doctor, who is the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, says the coronavirus outbreak will be even more difficult in the coming weeks. Yesterday, Oregon Governor Kate Brown issued an executive order that will prevent tenants from being evicted from their homes due to the COVID-19 pandemic. The order is effective immediately and will last 90 days. Brown noted that people who lose their homes will be more likely to catch and spread COVID-19 because they may have more trouble maintaining the appropriate distance from others. According to the executive order, law enforcement is prohibited from being involved with evicting tenants who cannot pay their rent. Residents can still be evicted for violations that do not relate to being able to pay rent. The Department of Consumer and Business Services has also issued a statement encouraging all Oregon-regulated lenders and loan services to provide assistance to borrowers, such as landlords who are having trouble making payments due to COVID-19. As most of us hunker down at home, grocery store workers still working around the public are getting some acknowledgement this week. Kroger, the parent company of Fred Meyer and QFC, is offering a temporary pay raise of $2 per hour in addition to other benefits to hourly workers still going in amid the coronavirus outbreak. The pay increases are expected to impact more than 460,000 workers nationwide. In addition to frontline workers, those employed at manufacturing plants, distribution centers, pharmacists, and contact call centers will also receive the pay increase. The raises are in place for 3 weeks, after which the decision will be revisited by Kroger and the union. Other benefits announced include emergency paid sick leave for associates affected by COVID-19, as well as one-time cash bonuses for hourly workers in certain departments. Other changes aimed at easing overtaxed employees will be the shortening of open hours to help aid in restocking, and plexiglass partitions at check lanes, pharmacies, and Starbucks registers to assist with physical distancing. Kroger will also be making funds available to employees facing COVID-19-related hardships, including access to childcare and mental health services. On March 19th, the Pacific Crest Trail Association asked everyone planning to hike the trail to cancel their trips due to the COVID-19 pandemic. On Saturday, a second statement from the association said that within 2 days, one hiker had died and multiple others had been to be rescued along the Pacific Crest Trail in the San Jacinto Mountains east of Los Angeles. The statement said that certain parts of the trail were extremely dangerous, which is normal during this season and could get worse. The association encourages people to avoid doing dangerous things outdoors because first responders should be focusing on the coronavirus pandemic. The Pacific Crest Trail Association does not have the authority to fully close the trail, which runs from Canada to Mexico, but it has been closing more facilities and sections of the trail. The association also reminded people that states along the trail, including Oregon, have issued bans on all non-essential travel, and since long-distance hiking is not essential travel, hiking the trail is currently illegal. Students who eat lunches in Battleground got a break this week in the form of an anonymous donation. Battleground Public Schools received $40,000 from an anonymous donor, paying for any outstanding school lunch debts. With students scheduled to return to school April 24th, the generous gift will relieve families of at least one financial burden as belts tighten around the pandemic. The donation was gifted through the Morgan Stanley Gift Fund and, with the exception of accounts already sent to collection, wipes out nearly all school lunch debt accrued by local families. The remaining debt of roughly $800 will be covered by the Battleground Education Foundation through its annual Kids in Need campaign. Megan Hayden, chief financial officer for Battleground Public Schools, called the donation exceptionally generous and told KGW, quote, "This is huge, especially right now when a lot of parents are probably wondering how they're going to pay their next mortgage or utilities," end quote. A Washington State nursing home that was hit hard by the coronavirus faces a fine of over $600,000 because of the way it handled the crisis. According to federal inspectors, the facility could also lose Medicare and Medicaid funding due to issues related to COVID-19. KBOO's Melissa Hood has more on the story.
According to King County, a nursing home located northeast of Seattle has experienced at least 129 confirmed COVID-19 cases and 37 deaths as of March 23rd. In a letter to Life Care Center of Kirkland on Wednesday, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services wrote that the nursing home failed to report an outbreak of respiratory illness to local authorities for 2 weeks as required by law, gave inadequate care to its residents during the outbreak, and failed to provide 24-hour emergency doctor services. The inspectors said that if the nursing home doesn't correct their flaws and begin working as the law states they should by September 16th, then CMS will no longer allow them to participate in their Medicare and Medicaid program. The facility could also lose its nurse aid training and competency evaluation program and forfeit federal payment for the patients it admitted from March 21st to March 27th. Inspectors imposed a fine of $13,585 per day for the alleged failings of the facility, beginning February 12th and continuing through March 27th. They said the fine could be raised or lowered depending on the facility's dedication to a correction plan. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Melissa Hood.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the Alberta Rose Theatre's Portland Music Stream series of concerts. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio, then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. At 8, we'll hear Ear to the Streets of Portland. Tonight's weather, temperatures are heading down to a low of 36 degrees overnight, partly cloudy with a 20% chance of rain. Tomorrow's weather Friday is looking mostly cloudy with a high of 52 degrees. We're looking at rainy and cool Saturday, up to 52, and mostly cloudy skies on Sunday, up to 60 for the high. Today in history, on this date in 1977, Fleetwood Mac's Rumours album went to number one and stayed there on the charts for 31 weeks. The quote of the day is from Fleetwood Mac singer Stevie Nicks, who said, quote, "I believe I was definitely sent down here to take people away for a little while, to make them happy." Some states this year used ranked choice voting in their primaries, and that has some real benefits when it comes to the COVID-19 crisis. With more on that story, here's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process.
You ought to be able to express the fullness of your opinion at the ballot box, and that's what the ranked choice really captures. You can do that in a caucus if you're able to spend, 5 hours. You ought to be able to do it by going 1, 2, 3 on a piece of paper as well.
David Daly, senior fellow at Fair Vote, an electoral reform nonprofit, says allowing voters to select a second choice, third or more, can be used in different ways to arrive at consensus-based winners. 5 states this cycle used ranked choice voting: Nevada, Kansas, Wyoming, Hawaii, and Alaska. The latter 3 states embraced mail-in voting for their primaries previously scheduled for this weekend after shifting away from caucuses. Daly says the combination makes voting more resilient.
These states that adopted early voting in RCV, maybe they've moved their deadline up a week or two, but they have not been in the position of chaos that you see in Wisconsin or a couple weeks ago in Ohio.
Yesterday, a Wisconsin judge heard arguments in a lawsuit to delay next week's primaries. No solution is perfect, according to Michigan voter Bendul Fraser.
I mean, it would be nice if we had ranked choice primary voting. The problem with that would be that nobody would drop out. Everybody would think like, oh, well, maybe I can be the guy eventually if enough things happen.
Fraser voted absentee for Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren before she dropped out ahead of Michigan's primary, rendering his vote moot. Fair Votes Daily says ranked choice would address that.
Voters should be able to vote early and vote by mail without having to fear that their candidate is going to drop out on the eve of the election and that their vote has been wasted.
Utah has been trying out ranked choice in some local elections. Democratic State Representative Patrice Arendt says the appeal is growing.
We've piloted that, and it worked in a couple of cities last year in conservative areas. And in polling after, people really liked it overwhelmingly. And it also, with ranked choice voting, ended up with a kinder, less negative election because candidates are less likely to say negative things about their opponents because they may want to be the voter's number two choice.
West Virginia joined the list of states delaying their primaries to June. President Trump confirmed yesterday that Obamacare exchanges won't be reopened during the COVID-19 outbreak. Former Vice President Joe Biden criticized that decision, saying it's, quote, jeopardizing Americans' access to health insurance in the midst of a global pandemic, unquote.
Well, that's why I'm strongly arguing that this administration drop their attempt to do away in court with Obamacare.
Biden also says the Democratic National Convention may not go on as planned. The Republican National Committee seems ready to go ahead with theirs, set for August. RNC Council said, quote, the show must go on. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Wolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
Colleges across the U.S. are waiving ACT and SAT score requirements in admissions due to test cancellations and rescheduling due to the COVID-19 crisis. The ACT pushed its April testing date to June, and the College Board pushed the May SAT date into June as well. The University of California announced Wednesday that it would be easing its admissions process by waiving standardized test requirements for all fall 2020 applicants. John A. Perez, chair of the UC Board of Regents, said, quote, "We want to help alleviate the tremendous disruption and anxiety that is already overwhelming prospective students due to COVID-19. University of Georgia, Alma College in Michigan, and Shriner University in Texas are among other institutions that have already decided to waive certain admission standards, such as standardized test scores. Students can still submit test scores if they've already taken the test, they just won't be rejected or ridiculed for not submitting test scores. The Democratic National Convention has been delayed from July to the week of August 17th because of coronavirus. The committee planning the event made that announcement about the delay today. The party has been working for months to host the convention in Milwaukee in mid-July. The committee consulted with representatives for former Vice President Joe Biden and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, the remaining candidates in the race for president. Democrats had chosen the July dates as a way to hold their convention before the 2020 Summer Olympics in Tokyo. But after the Olympics were delayed a year because of the virus, that left the time frame open for Democrats. The Democratic convention is now scheduled to happen the week immediately before the Republican convention in Charlotte. Top Democrats started looking at contingency plans last month, including changing the date, shortening the in-person part of the gathering, or even going entirely digital. The effort sped up after Biden, who was leading in the delegate count, began to call for changes, including stating publicly that the convention, quote, will have to move into August. Two Native women are among the latest victims who've lost their lives due to the new coronavirus. With that story and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Two members of the Pascua Yaqui tribe have died related to COVID-19, the Arizona Daily Star reports. According to the tribe, the two members were women who lived off the reservation. The tribal health department is working with Pima County Health to notify family. They're recommending anyone who had close contact with the women to self-isolate. The tribal health department is conducting limited testing on the reservation. Pima County, as of Wednesday, had 10 coronavirus-related deaths and more than 200 known cases. The Navajo Nation saw positive COVID-19 cases increase by 40 between Tuesday and Wednesday. As of Wednesday night, positive tests reached 214, with 7 deaths related to the coronavirus. More than half of the cases are in Arizona, some in Utah, and the rest in New Mexico. Tribal leaders say they're seeking more test kits and on-site labs as they expect numbers to continue to grow. Navajo leaders are urging residents on the reservation to stay at home. President Jonathan Nez was handing out information outside a grocery store in Window Rock, Arizona, Wednesday, asking people to prepare for the next few weeks.
Once you get your supplies, hunker down for the next 2 to 3 weeks. We're trying to slow down and stop the spread of coronavirus here on the Navajo Nation.
The tribe has a number of emergency orders in place, including a nightly curfew, which went into effect on Monday. Medical martial law will go into effect Friday on the Red Lake Nation in Minnesota. Stay-at-home orders and a nightly curfew are in place on the reservation. Chairman Daryl Seeke Sr. declared the medical martial law executive order Wednesday. He delivered an address to tribal citizens through social media, saying COVID-19 is threatening the community.
Medical martial law means that expanded executive authorities are in effect and permits streamlined decision making by the chairman to swiftly address threats to the safety and security of tribal members.
The chairman says while there are no positive cases on the reservation, credible reports indicate a member who lives off the reservation has tested positive for the coronavirus and may travel to Red Lake. Travel to and from the reservation will be monitored. In South Dakota, the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe has set up checkpoints at major roadways on its reservation in response to COVID-19. Starting Thursday, checkpoints will monitor traffic allowed through the reservation. All out-of-state non-commercial drivers will not be allowed past checkpoints unless they have proof of tribal membership and reservation residency. The tribe has several emergency orders in place to address COVID-19, including travel bans and the restriction of visitors from off the reservation. The New Mexico Department of Indian Affairs is working with tribes as the state recently announced schools will be closed for the rest of the academic school year due to COVID-19. New Mexico Indian Affairs Cabinet Secretary Lynn Trujillo says the department is in weekly contact with tribal leaders about needs, including food supplies and funding.
We are also looking at our budget and working with sister agencies to see where we can make buys and purchases to meet the needs in our tribal communities. There are a variety of needs that are in our tribal communities. And one of the challenges that we're working on is transportation and how to get these resources that are available out into our tribal communities that are very remote.
She says most federal and tribally controlled schools are closed. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The national stockpile of personal protective equipment called PPE is almost empty. The federal government is scrambling to get more essential items like masks and gloves to deal with the coronavirus pandemic. One official with the Department of Homeland Security told the Washington Post, quote, "The stockpile was designed to respond to a handful of cities. It was never built or designed to fight a 50-state pandemic. This is not only a U.S. government problem. The supply chain for PPE worldwide has broken down, and there's a lot of price gouging happening." Hospitals across the country have been trying to supply doctors and nurses responding to the COVID-19 epidemic with protective gear. But social media posts are showing medical professionals wearing trash bags over their regular clothing. Hospitals are now acknowledging that they're having difficulty getting PPE. The coronavirus outbreak has now sickened more than 190,000 people in the United States, more than any country in the world. President Trump, who's been criticized for a lack of planning, confirmed on Wednesday that there is a shortage. He said, quote, "It is because we're sending it directly to hospitals. We don't want it to come to the stockpile because then we have to take it after it arrives and bring it to various states and hospitals." The president says he is urging states to, quote, "make a deal and buy personal protective equipment directly from manufacturers." With so many stuck at home during the novel coronavirus crisis, people are turning to the video call service Zoom for a variety of communication needs, but not without some major security concerns. Company meetings, school classes, weddings, funerals, and government business are just some of the services using Zoom's streaming platform, skyrocketing the Silicon Valley-based firm's market value to over $35 billion for 2020, excuse me. As the demand for its product grows, so do concerns over issues relating to user security, privacy, and potential harassment. It was initially launched as a business video chat platform, but Zoom's engineers bypassed certain safeguards in efforts to make the service faster and more efficient for users. Technical experts are saying these shortcuts make it easier for hackers to access private information and snoop on people's lives. Jarring revelations from security experts have pointed to flaws in Zoom that could allow strangers to steal login information and control users' cameras, microphones, and private messages. Amid criticism following these shortcomings, Zoom Chief Executive Eric Yuan told the public in a Wednesday blog post that all of the company's engineering resources focus on safety and privacy improvements for the next 90 days. New York Attorney General Letitia James asked how the company planned on protecting their user data, and how it is stored, shared, and safeguarded. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 2nd, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast, our remote production team for tonight's newscast, excuse me, includes Melissa Hood, Jeffrey Wade, Ken Jones, Jenka Soderberg, and Yasmin Kobanoglu. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bulkey and Antonia Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 VH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
We're joined now by Leonardo Flores. He is the Latin American Campaign Coordinator for Code Pink, based in Washington, D.C. And we are here to talk about the situation in Venezuela and Venezuela's coronavirus response, the impact of U.S. sanctions, and the U.S. drug charges that the United States filed against the Venezuelan president. And I wonder if we could maybe start with those drug charges. Why, in the midst of a pandemic, is the U.S. government indicting president of Venezuela?
Right. So in March, the State Department outlined, well, first of all, thank you for having me on the show. In March, the U.S. State Department outlined a new strategy for Venezuela, or rather, an updating of its strategy, and they called it Maximum Pressure March. They threatened to implement more sanctions, which they did. Trump himself made a threat of imposing a naval blockade on the country, and today we found out the news, Wednesday, we found out the news that the Trump administration is sending naval ships off the Venezuelan coastline. And then, of course, we have these indictments set out by the Department of Justice regarding the drug trade. So it's part of this regime change effort, this hybrid war that the Trump administration has been carrying out on Venezuela. And the fact that it's going on, that there's no kind of ceasefire in this hybrid war during this global pandemic, really speaks to a sort of ruthlessness in the Trump administration's regime change efforts. This hybrid war, and specifically sanctions imposed by the Trump administration, has caused 100,000 deaths already in Venezuela. That's according to Alfred de Sayas, the former UN Special Rapporteur. And that was before the pandemic had occurred. And now we see Trump kind of doubling down on his regime change efforts, ignoring the pleas for global ceasefire that we've seen from everyone from the UN to the EU, and really kind of amping up the pressure at a time that really should be where we should be focusing on global health instead of warfare.
And this accusation against Maduro is that he was working with the Colombian militia group, the FARC, to flood the United States with cocaine, is in some ways an attempt by the United States to overthrow the president of Venezuela. It seems they haven't succeeded in doing that in their previous attempts, right?
Yeah, that's correct. And so these indictments are pretty preposterous. You're right. They blame Maduro. They claim that Maduro has this plot to import 250 tons of cocaine per year into the United States. But the facts don't bear that out. 90%, and this is according to the U.S. government's own statistics, 90% of the cocaine in the United States comes either directly from Colombia or transits Colombia. Only 7% of the routes of the cocaine that comes to the United States flows through Venezuela. And I have to emphasize that Venezuela neither produces the poppy, the coca leaf, nor produces cocaine. It is indeed a transit country for cocaine, but what Venezuela contributes to this global drug trade is a drop in the bucket to what Colombia does. Colombia is the world's biggest producer of cocaine, and of course the United States is the world's biggest consumer. So the fact that they're focusing on Venezuela while ignoring Colombia, or not just ignoring, but continuing to give billions of dollars in military aid to Colombia, the world's number one producer, tells me that this really isn't about cocaine at all. It's a political ploy to put more pressure on the Maduro government and, you know, to try to force regime change. It's all been about regime change for the Trump administration since he came into office, because he gets a lot of funding and a lot of support from right-wing Cuban Americans and Venezuelan Americans in Florida, which is a very important swing state, as you know.
And speaking of Florida, 800 Venezuelans in the U.S. took an emergency flight from Miami last week to return to Venezuela. From what we're hearing on the major media in the U.S., they're returning to a country that is chaotic, that is unable to cope with the pandemic. Why are they returning, and what's the situation in Venezuela right now?
So it turned out that the Trump administration actually blocked the flight. So these people weren't able to return. We're talking about some people who had been stuck in the United States and had been planning to travel to Venezuela, go back home to Venezuela, but flights were canceled. Others who are in the United States and would rather ride out the coronavirus epidemic in Venezuela. And yeah, the mainstream media portrays it as this chaos and a huge disaster waiting to happen, but the facts don't really bear that out in this case. So far, Venezuela has 143 cases of coronavirus with 3 deaths. This comes 20 days after the first case was confirmed. And Venezuela, despite having its health sector decimated by the brutal U.S. sanctions that have been imposed on it, has been able to kind of stem the coronavirus because of very strict measures taken by the government. Like, for example, on day 4, on the 4th day of the coronavirus being present in Venezuela, there were 17 cases, I believe, in the country. And just with those 17 cases in a country of 30 million people, that the government decided to order a nationwide quarantine, which is something we still haven't even seen here in the U.S., where we have, cities like New York and New Orleans and towns all over the place kind of succumbing to this epidemic or becoming dire in many places.
And yet the U.S. continues to place sanctions on Venezuela. What is the U.S. justification for the sanctions, and what's the impact?
So the U.S. justification for the sanctions is that they consider the Maduro government to be illegitimate. This really stems from presidential elections in 2018, where the U.S. really interfered very clearly, and they interfered by threatening candidates who were trying to run and telling them they may be sanctioned if they ran, and that led to an opposition boycott of that election, leading to a Maduro victory. And so the U.S. goal behind the sanctions is to force regime change within the country. Their fantasy, which has really no basis at all in reality, is that the people were going to rise up and overthrow the government because of the sanctions. What poll after poll tells us in Venezuela is that the United States and the Venezuelan members of the opposition who advocated for sanctions are increasingly being blamed for the impacts of the sanctions. And so I mentioned earlier the 100,000 deaths as a result of the sanction. And it's not that sanctions directly kill people, it's that they decimate the economy, they decimate the health sector, and then health results become worse. So for example, there have been $130 billion in losses to the Venezuelan economy as a result of the sanctions, a 90% drop in foreign currency earnings, and Venezuela is an oil-based economy. So a lot of the early sanctions focused on the oil sector. And this had an impact on the country's health indicators. For example, undernourishment rose from 2% in 2013 to 13.4% in 2018. Maternal mortality rose from 68 deaths per every 100,000 live births in 2013 to 135 deaths per 100,000 live births in 2017. So double the maternal mortality. And these are kind of the statistics throughout, health indicators throughout the country show this clear deterioration in the well-being of Venezuelans. And it's very clearly linked to the sanctions, because prior to the sanctions, since 1999, when the Bolivarian revolution began in Venezuela, health indicators had been, you know, doing very, very well, because the government had been investing very heavily in all, not just health, but also in education.
Wow. And right now, as the world is facing this pandemic, the international solidarity is something that the U.S. has not engaged in much, but other countries like Venezuela have, including Cuba, that has just 130 cases of COVID-19, two deaths, but have deployed doctors all over the world, including to Venezuela. What are some of the lessons that we can learn from countries like Cuba and Venezuela in their leadership and dealing with the situations like the one the world is in now?
Yeah, I mean, what we're seeing right now is countries like Cuba and China taking the lead in fighting this disease at a global level. And the United States, which generally like takes pride in being a global leader with an event such as these have occurred, they've been very silent. And so what we're seeing, particularly in Latin America, is that the countries that are friendly towards Cuba and China and Russia and the other countries that are demonized by the United States have received aid, whereas the countries that rely on the U.S. have not received much aid. And so, you know, especially we really have to highlight, as you did, the Cuban solidarity. They've sent doctors all over the world, and not just doctors, but Cuba has a drug called interferon alpha 2b that is shown to be effective against COVID-19. And they sent Venezuela 10,000 doses of this drug. And they sent this drug everywhere in the world. It's still not available here in the U.S. because of the sanctions. But, you know, I think what we're learning is that the world, it doesn't work the way that the Trump administration and the State Department want to tell us it works. It's not, America isn't really a global leader anymore. And it's not because it can't be, but it's because it doesn't want to be. And the Trump administration has been engaging in kind of almost like a sort of isolationism, but an isolationism while at the same time arming countries that want to engage in solidarity. And so the Trump administration has gone after these Cuban doctors, accusing them of being, or accusing the program of engaging in human trafficking, when really this program is saving lives all over the world and preventing the pandemic from being worse. And we saw that, we're seeing that not just with COVID-19, but we saw it a few years ago as well with the Ebola crisis.
Sorry, human trafficking? How is having doctors go to different places in the world engaging in human trafficking? I don't understand that logic.
Yeah, that's a great question. So what the Trump administration alleges is that the doctors are forced to go and work in other countries, and that they have to send all of their salaries back to Cuba. Neither of those things are true. The doctors are volunteers, and they do have to send some of their salaries back to Cuba, because that's the agreement that was reached with them. But not all. They get to live, you know, in other countries, and they receive salaries and live like normal people. It's really kind of another absurdity by the Trump administration and its attempts to demonize not just Cuba, but anything that even whiffs of socialism.
Hmm. Do you think that this global pandemic and the varying responses to it could mark an end to U.S. imperialism, or the U.S. Declaring itself as the sole superpower in the world post-Cold War?
Well, we'll have to see really how the rest of the world reacts. Because one of the biggest enablers of U.S. imperialism in the world is the European Union. Another huge enabler is Canada. Already the European Union has kind of come out against the sanctions during this time of pandemic, and they've asked the U.S. to grant sanctions relief for Venezuela and Iran, among others. We've seen kind of the pressure turning up on the Trump administration regarding these sanctions, not just from the EU, but also the UN. Even people in Congress are starting to question it. I think it's, you know, too soon to say whether this will be a death knell from U.S. imperialism. I really doubt it because of the billions and billions we spend on defense every year. I think something like $780 billion a year. But I hope that people will come to realize just how much damage U.S. foreign policy has been causing around the world. And really, as we're living through this pandemic and we're hearing from old friends and we're taking care of our neighbors and we're, you know, engaging in mutual aid throughout our communities, what I really hope is that people kind of internalize this and kind of apply it to our foreign policy. Instead of being the world's, you know, policeman or bully, the United States should really start acting like a good neighbor.
Is there any movement in Congress to lifting the sanctions on Iran and Venezuela at this time?
Yes. So in Congress, there's two letters that are being signed by various representatives and senators. One of them deals only with the sanctions on Iran, and another one that's led by Senator Chris Murphy deals with the sanctions in Iran on Venezuela. It's a little more limited in scope, and that one is basically lifting the sanctions for humanitarian reasons. Also, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, about a month ago, released new legislation to grant greater oversight over sanctions, because sanctions, you know, as a foreign policy tool, it's very attractive to our representatives and senators because it doesn't mean boots on the ground, it doesn't mean bombs, and it, you know, doesn't mean direct deaths. But as we learn more and more about the impacts of sanctions, they clearly cause indirect deaths, they clearly cause suffering, and they're a collective punishment of civilians, which is really like a war crime. And so I think that their mentality surrounding sanctions is beginning to change in Congress, and I hope that that's what one thing that will come out of this horrible pandemic.
Well, thanks so much. And again, people can contact their senators and Congress members about supporting those letters. Leonardo Flores with Code Pink. And again, we'll have links to these articles that have been published by Leonardo Flores, Venezuela's Coronavirus Response Might Surprise You, on Code Pink, and that will be on KBOO.FM. This is Jenka Soderberg reporting for KBOO News.
The coronavirus pandemic has hit our local musicians and music venues here in Portland especially hard. And as with many of us, they're adapting to the demands of social distancing and staying home by going online. That's the reason for the new Portland Music Stream series presented by one of our favorite local venues, the Alberta Rose Theater. The Alberta Rose originally opened as a movie house in 1927, the year of Al Jolson's Jazz Singer, and showed films until it closed in 1978. It was reopened in 1998, and since then has become one of Portland's top spots for live music and performance. To find out more about the Portland Music Stream series, we're joined now via Skype by Adam East, talent buyer for the Alberta Rose Theater. Adam, thanks very much for taking time out to talk with us at KBOO.
Yeah, no problem, Ken. Thank you so much for inviting me.
And Adam, since these are unusual times, I don't usually start off an interview this way, but I'm just going to ask how you're doing. Are you doing most of your work from home?
Yeah, I'm doing all my work from home now. And I'm doing okay, you know, as well as can be expected, I think.
Oh my, we're all going through it, yeah. When did the Alberta Rose shut down for live performances? Was that around the 10th or so, something like that?
The last show we did was March 14th.
Oh, my.
It was when we had been ordered to keep things under 250 people. And so we happened to have one show that was still on the docket that was we had sold just right around 250 tickets, and so everybody was ready to keep that one together and not cancel it. So we did that one, and then we shut the doors.
Oh my! And I should mention to listeners that the capacity is closer to 400 if you had a sellout show.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, you've adapted to the COVID-19 precautions by going online with this new series, the Portland Music Stream. How'd you come up with the idea, and were there any models or inspirations from other venues here in Portland or nationally?
Well, when we had to close the roads to live shows, I was looking for a way for us to stay active and to keep money rolling in, because we've got bills to pay, and to keep our employees working. And so the Portland Music Stream was originally conceived as a way to use the Alberta Rose as a soundstage instead of a live performance venue. We were gonna have engineers and a live stream camera team and use the empty Alberta Rose Theater as the stage, and use all the equipment that we have to produce live shows to produce live streamed shows. And that idea almost came to fruition. We spent a day getting everything all together, setting up the stage, checking all the connections and the live stream situation there, and then the order came for us to stay inside. And so at that point we switched gears and turned the thing into a series of concerts performed and streamed from artists' homes instead, and that's where we got to where we are today. Luckily, our live stream crew has been doing this sort of thing for many, many years. I'd say 20 years or more. And so I had confidence that we'd be able to take this thing mobile and do all the live streaming remotely. And that's what we've done. And it's been a bit of an odyssey, and it's worked out well so far.
Now, the first concert in the series was Michael Dean Damron. He's in the band I Can Lick Any SOB in the House, a Portland band. That was March 21st, so about 10 days ago. Since then, you've presented, I counted, seven more. What's been the response from the musicians you've talked with and the folks listening at home?
Well, all the musicians have been happy to have a gig. That's for sure. Because when this came down, it was such a hit to the pocketbook. And I think, you know, musicians thrive on playing music, and it was an opportunity to do what they do best. So we've had a lot of positive feedback. When I first approached the artists about this, I was very happy, and I guess not surprised, but happy to see that everybody wanted to do it. Since we've been doing it, the feedback that I've gotten has been really positive. The artists have felt a great sense of joy and relief to actually be able to have a concert and connect with people. They've all said that it's been strange and a little bit scary.
Oh, not having an audience, yeah.
Not having an audience in the room to play for. But, you know, there's a chat box on your screen when you're watching the show, and we encourage people who are viewing to enter the chat room and request songs or make comments, applaud the performers, tell a joke, whatever it is that they've got. And that's really helped build a sense of community during a concert and given the performers the feeling and the knowledge that they're actually connecting with people out there.
Now, what's the setup like for the performers? Are they live streaming from home, just them and their instrument?
Yes, and It's a little bit different every time, but generally they're finding a place in their home, setting it up so it is a comfortable and good sounding and good looking space to do a concert, and using whatever hardware it is that they've got. Usually it's a laptop, sometimes it's a phone. If they have a more elaborate setup, external microphones or, you know, a proper SLR camera that they can connect, we're able to roll with any of those technical options. But generally, yeah, it's people live streaming a concert from their home, either sitting in front of the fireplace or on their front porch.
That sounds great. It is. Now, Adam, you're offering the Portland Music Stream shows as a subscription service, but also pay by the concert deal. Can you talk about the subscription service first, how it works, what's included?
Sure. It was originally intended to just be subscription only, because the hope was that we would raise enough money to sustain the Alberta Rose Theater through this time and make enough money to pay the musicians handsomely enough for their time that it was a win-win for everyone. And so the subscription model was dreamt up in order to raise a good chunk of money that'll help all those things. And we added the single show tickets later on, and that's been good too. It's not everyone can afford $100. Not everyone wants all the shows. Some people are just fans of a certain artist, and they're able to pay, you know, what's about the same as they might pay when they go to see that concert in person. But they get the experience of the live streamed concert, and they get to view the archived show in perpetuity. They get to see the show and get to see the concert on demand anytime they may want.
And in addition to helping out the Alberta Rose during this time, the concert series also helps our local artists. You're doing this through the Jeremy Wilson Foundation. Can you talk about that?
Sure. The Jeremy Wilson Foundation is a musicians' healthcare organization that provides relief for musicians in need. They started a COVID-19 fund when this whole thing came down, and we are donating a portion of the profits to the JWF. And the way that we conceived of this was to scale up the donation portion of the revenue. So the more people we get subscribing to the series, the larger the percentage we get to donate to charity. And so once we meet our basic financial goals in helping support the Alberta Rose Theater and the artists, we'll end up giving the lion's share to the Jeremy Wilson Foundation.
Now, we should mention a few of the concerts coming up, and they're incredible for fans of local music, or music in general. Justin John, Adam King of the Garcia Birthday Band, they're playing Friday night. Tony Furtado, Stephanie Schneiderman on Saturday. One of my favorites, Tave Fache Drake, she's the lead singer of the Girl Haggard Band. She'll be performing on Sunday. Just an incredible lineup. And in terms of the actual live shows, the ones you've had to cancel, you had some really good ones coming up this month. Ruthie Foster, Maria Muldaur. There's the Nowhere Band. We're going to do Abbey Road, which I saw last year. It was just amazing. Are you in the process of rescheduling them, or just kind of sitting on things right now to see how long this quarantine lasts and what's going to happen?
Yeah, at this point, we have all the shows up to a certain date, whatever that date was, April 18th, are either rescheduled or postponed. And we watch the news and we wait to hear from the the powers that be as to how much longer they're predicting this whole thing is going to last. And when they do extend the orders, we begin to reschedule the shows that we're going to have to miss. So we're just in the process now of rescheduling and or having to cancel or postpone all the shows for the rest of April.
How can people find out more about the Portland Music Stream series and subscribe if they like, or even buy individual concerts?
Just go to the Alberta Rose Theater website, which is albertarosetheater.com, and at the top you'll see a big image for Portland Music Stream, and click on that and you'll find all the information that you need to subscribe. And then if you're looking for individual shows, then you can page down and find the shows listed just as if they were regular live shows. The individual tickets are listed in chronological order right there.
Well, Adam, again, thanks so much for talking with us. It's a wonderful program, a way for us who are staying at home and sheltering in place to stay entertained and for the performers to keep performing. So thank you for all that.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity here to tell people about it. And we love putting on shows at the Alberta Rose, and we love the theater and really want to keep it going. So we appreciate all the support from the community, and we'll see you online.
Oh, thanks, Adam.
Thank you, Ken.
We've been talking with Adam East, talent buyer for the Alberta Rose Theater. You can find out more about the Portland Music Stream series and how to help support the Alberta Rose and our local musicians online at Alberta Rose Theater. That's theater with an R-E at the end.
This is Ramona Africa, and you're listening to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 on your dial. KBOO is the exact example of the community taking charge of itself on the move.